Happy June, writers and readers. I'm Christy Mathern.
And I'm Avery Brooks.
And you're listening to the Western Colorado Writers Podcast, where we talk to writers about writing. For our June episode, we're celebrating Pride Month, so we're going to talk to a few amazing LGBTQ plus writers who are doing awesome things in the writing world. First up, we have slam poet extraordinaire Caleb Verganschik with us in the studio today.
Okay, so here's a quick rundown on Caleb. Caleb is the published LGBTQ plus poet behind Slamming Bricks, Colorado's biggest LGBTQ plus slam poetry competition, which is held in Grand Junction every year. He has published two volumes of poetry, The Secret of Sunflowers and Poetry Heals. Caleb's poetry has been published in the Colorado Mesa University Literary Review, the Blue Sage Center for the Arts Harvest of Voices, and the South Broadway Ghost Society series Language of the Earth.
Caleb is also a stand-up paddleboard river guide, a speech and debate coach, treasurer for mutual aid partners, and a secretary on the board of the Western Colorado Writers Forum. He dreams of creating a queer commune with river otter rescue and falconry. Caleb, thanks for coming in to chat with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So, in 2019, you created Slamming Bricks, A Riot on First Street, an annual slam poetry competition during Pride Week in Grand Junction to explore resistance and liberation in honor of the 1969 Stonewall Riots. Can you talk a little bit more about what led to the creation of this event, what it is, and who participates?
Yeah, so Slamming Bricks actually kind of came from a blueprint from another poetry slam event that I had visited in Moab. So I think 2015, 2016 is when I first went. It was called Spit Love. At the time, I lived in a household full of drag queens. And so we would travel to different Pride events. And so we happened to be in Moab. And it was, I think, maybe their second year doing Spit Love. And it was just an LGBTQ-themed poetry slam competition that coincided with their Pride. It was the first time, I think, that I had seen so many queer people that didn't look like me in a rural setting talking about just like their intersectional experiences. And it was just a really eye-opening experience where I felt like I could be authentically vulnerable and celebrate myself and my community. And I really wanted to create something like that here in Grand Junction. So I did, talk with the creator of Spit Love. Their name is Cal Bullmoose, who's a great community activist, puppeteer, on top of being a slam poet. And so kind of got the groundwork for how they had first established Spit Love and coordinated with some of the poets who I had met there to create Slamming Bricks. At the time, I didn't really know who to reach out to for support or funding to build something like that. So it was just a lot of like cold door knocking on businesses in Grand Junction, asking for sponsorships for the event. And it was kind of a create it on the fly sort of thing. And it turned out super successful and greater than I could have expected. And it's really grown into something that I think is special, especially for a rural community on the western slope of Colorado. So we have 10 poets every year who compete, poets from Grand Junction, Montrose, or, you know, the larger Western Slope area. We've had poets from the Front Range, but then also poets from other states in the American West. So Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, California, and Oregon right now. And we've also been really lucky to feature some prominent poets like Bobby Lefebvre, who judged for us during the second year of Slamming Bricks. And last year, HBO's We're Here was also in town filming for their second season, and the drag queen Eureka O'Hara visited and performed a piece in one of the community slots that we do.
Nice. So what are some of the accomplishments you're most proud of in terms of participants and reach?
Yeah, I think what I'm most proud of is like how Slamming Bricks has allowed me to connect to queer artists in this community that I think I otherwise would not have met. So just being able to create an intentional space that is safe for everyone, and not just queer people, but also BIPOC people or people living with different abilities, and creating a space where folks can fully participate in their authentic identities. So, yeah, for me, it's just being able to meet those people and talk about writing. And then even outside of writing, being able to connect on larger community projects or community activism and using Slamming Bricks as kind of that launching point.
In 2021, the Western Colorado Writers Forum and the Colorado Arts and Society helped fund the creation of the first Slamming Bricks anthology. Can you talk about how the anthology differs and complements the slam poetry competition and how it reflects your original mission?
Yeah, so I'm really thankful to Avery Bricks, who stepped in during our second year to help with that anthology process. And I, you know, knew nothing about how to kind of solicit submissions or put together an anthology like that. And so for me, I think it differs like in the sense that it's written word instead of spoken word, obviously, and it's a little bit more traditional poetry format. But I think what's great about it is it takes the spirit of Slamming Bricks and creating that intentional space for people to be authentic, and it reaches a much wider even international audience. So we're able to have, you know, BIPOC and queer and AAPI poets, you know, publish their work and share that work across a much wider audience.
Great. So you grew up in Delta, a rural conservative town in Western Colorado. How did living on the Western Slope and its demographics impact your journey as an LGBTQ plus individual and activist, as well as your journey to writing?
Yeah, so I think to start this off, I'm going to quote my poetry friend who has competed at Slamming Bricks for all 3 years, Brianna Hammerstrom, that we gays love arts and crafts, not because we want to, but because we have to. And I think a lot of people, right, wind up in activism work in that capacity. You know, they're exposed to hardship or discrimination that really is the catalyst for them getting involved for advocacy for themselves or people that they love. Growing up in Delta was incredibly tough. It was, you know, the school district was not at all supportive of queer youth or queer kids. I'm a survivor of suicide from the result of being bullied in, you know, Delta. And so I grew up in a very religious and hyper-conservative household and family. And so I think learning to break away from that and self-advocate for myself in order to live as my authentic self is really where kind of my just stepping into activism came from. So really just having to learn how to build my own armor so that I could survive. So I think since, you know, living in Grand Junction and being able to commit to a larger community, I've just been really motivated to build that community that I didn't have as a kid or be the person that I needed when I was a kid. So, yeah, it was a tough place, and I'm not necessarily thankful for it, but I am thankful to myself for what I've been able to accomplish as far as surviving and now what I would consider, I think, thriving as a queer person in a rural community.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get started writing poetry, and how did it play a role in processing those experiences, your identity, and then getting to self-understanding and even self-acceptance?
Yeah, I think most of my poetry, I mean, I just refer to most of my poetry as cognitive behavioral therapy. I started poetry at a very, very young age. I can remember, you know, being like 4 or 5 years old and finding my grandmother's poetry books in her desk. You know, she was a Democrat, one of the only Democrats in the family who had gotten a creative writing associates from Mesa State College back when it was still Mesa State College. But wow. She really introduced me, I think, to poetry. And so I would, you know, sneak into her desk and read from her poetry journals. And so I remember like being a little kid and just trying to like emulate, you know, the format of poetry. I grew up on an orchard in the Gunnison Canyon between Austin and Hotchkiss. And so I think as a little kid, a lot of my writing reflected just kind of the natural world around me. Mm. But I think I really, really started connecting to poetry when I was in the second grade and my grandfather passed. And so it was the first time I really used poetry as a way to process emotions or just, you know, use language as a way to communicate what I was going through. So, yeah, throughout middle school, even still, I was still processing kind of that grief and doing poetry to do so. My first poem is about my grief related to my first poem that was published was about my grief related to my grandfather that was like published in one of those middle school anthologies that they like sell like super overpriced just to all the parents.
Oh, they know they're going to get the yeah.
But yeah, and so I think I've just, yeah, really leaned on poetry to process, you know, all of the emotions that come with being a marginalized individual in a rural community. And then learning how to use poetry as a form of activism to mobilize people or give people a place where they can feel seen and connected.
So. Awesome. What made you want to move from writing poetry to performing it as a slam poet?
Yeah, I think the first time I really started performing poetry was in college, just at like open mic nights that the university would throw on, or some of like the local theaters. And that was just like a really big light bulb moment for me, because I think there's a significant difference between writing, writing anything and then actually performing it, particularly with slam poetry. And I think that I've kind of learned, you know, I spent a lot of time as a young queer person just, you know, being like tone policed or told that, like, you know, I didn't know what was best for me. And so not being listened to for self-advocacy. So slam poetry became a way that I could stand on a stage and yell at people and they had to listen. And then learning how to craft that into an art where it really resonated with people, even if they didn't have direct experience to foster conversations. So, it's become a great experience for me. And I think going back to the cognitive behavioral therapy thing, I really use it as a place to just perform my poetry and talk about trauma or talk about mental illness in a way that is framed and conceptualized that I can always control. And so it's just for that moment, it's that stage in that poetry, and I can work through it, and then I can set it down and go on with my life.
Awesome. Where did you get the courage to be on stage, or was it hard for you to do that?
No. Not to like queer stereotype myself, but I was always the kid, you know, like putting on musical theater productions with like my sister and like our friends as a little kid. I've never been shy in front of a microphone. I think it just kind of came pretty naturally to me. But I also think the courage, to be vulnerable like that does in some aspects come from just, you know, growing up as a queer person in a rural community and learning how to kind of take that hate and vitriol and let it, you know, roll off or to turn that anger into something that's purposeful.
Well, let me ask a question off that then, since you weren't nervous necessarily. Is there, when you're performing certain pieces, that you get maybe more nervous?
Yeah, I think there's still definitely nervousness. I mean, even like, especially when you're competing, you still have like competition nerves or anxiety. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, sometimes when I still do open mics here in Grand Junction, like I was just at a brewery where they're kind of doing an open story format, and it was the first time I was there. And so it is always, a little nerve wracking to try and read and piece out the crowd at first. So I always try and kind of buffer it with some jokes just to kind of fill out the room. But I think nervousness is natural when you're performing or competing. But I think I was just naturally drawn to being on a stage. So,
cool.
How did you perfect the craft of performing? Did it change a lot over time?
Yeah, I think it's definitely changed. I think, you know, when I first started writing poetry and then really discovered slam poetry, I think I tried to model like my poems off of other people or like other forms of expression or rhythm that I really liked. But I think as I've done it, you know, for more years, I've really learned that, like, I think good slam poetry is just about being authentic as invulnerable as possible. And people ask me all the time to, like, help lead writing workshops. And I feel incredibly underqualified to do so just because I think for me, writing is just me leaning into my natural voice and kind of sitting with myself and asking, you know, like, does this sound right? Is this what I intend to say? So I think from the writing process, that's where it comes from. But then performing, so instead of like singing in the shower or singing in the car, like I will slam in the shower or slam in the car. So I will like record myself reading a slam poetry that I've written in the way that I want it to sound. And then just like with my favorite song, like I will play it in my car or in the shower and perform along with it until it's kind of in my head, which I'm sure is a really entertaining sight for people that happen to be driving in the same area that I do.
So what do you look for in a slam poet's performance that takes it for you from being something that's good to something that's great?
Yeah, I think going back to that vulnerability thing, I think I've seen a lot of like marginalized poets who really take social commentary, but then drive it home with just like a personal experience that I just think takes so much bravery, to own and then present on a stage, or to take something like so traumatic and then decide that like they get to own that trauma and they get to set the boundaries or the parameters of that trauma and then to turn it into something that's beautiful, I think, for me, is what makes great slam poetry.
Mm-hmm. So which slam poetry performers have impressed you lately?
I think I am just, like, always really in love with, like, you know, those small, like, slam poets who are still doing, like, their own community open mic nights or things like that. I think here locally, I just met a poet named Ian McLaughlin, who I am really impressed with in his ability to rhyme and just his, like, beat skills, which is something I absolutely do not have. And so when I get to see that or hear that, it always gives me goosebumps or chills, and it's just kind of like a blows my mind sort of deal, because, yeah, I have no idea how he does it. Also really impressed by two of the slam poets who came to Slamming Bricks last year, Nico Wilkinson and Eric Francis. And they both, I think, have like a grasp on social like commentary and activism slam poetry that is just absolutely wild. Nico has a poem about mental illness on trial and just kind of flipping the argument that folks with mental illness are a danger to society on its head through like the abusive criminal justice system and prison industrial complex. So I think like more well-known poets that I like to follow or that I'm interested into, the two that I always like tell people about are Mariah Lambert. She's the female vocalist in Macklemore's, what's the song? I Can't Change. Is that the title?
Yeah.
So
I'm not sure that's the title, but
yeah. But yeah, she's the female vocalist in that, and she has a book of poetry called Shame is an Ocean that I swim across. In particular, there's a poem about iceberg lettuce that is just super, super good. And then the other is Dinesh Smith and his book, Don't Call Us Dead. And it's a great collection of black queer poetry and kind of combating his experiences with police brutality.
Mm. And Mariah is a queer slam poet as well, right?
Yes, yeah. Yep.
Awesome. Can you talk about how you translate a performance piece into the written word? I think you covered this. The written part comes first, right?
Yeah, I write. I think I don't write poetry with the intention of it being read first. So, like, I am not thinking about, like, the stylistic choices or my stanzas or my line breaks or anything like that when I'm first writing. I think my focus is always just writing in a way that I can then read it in the way that I want to present it. So the actual written process, then, when if I ever want to take the pieces that I write for slam poems and then put them into something that I publish, is always a little tricky for me. Mm-hmm. I think I don't have like a lot of formal experience or education around poetry. And so I also think like I struggle with like the permanence of a published poem, because I think as a performer, like I am constantly adapting or changing sometimes how I perform a piece or even some of the lines or the languages in the piece. So that published poetry, I think, is a little uncomfortable for me sometimes because it's super permanent. But.
Yeah, there's something final about it when it's like on the page and you can't change it.
So you have a bit of slam poetry out there. How do you make that decision what to actually publish in the written format or... Because I would imagine you have more that you've performed, right, than maybe you published in
your the first chapbook that I released was really just kind of like a poetry journal. It was just a collection of pieces that I had written or performed, you know, over the course of 2 years. And there wasn't really like a unifying theme or a selection process to it. And I called it Poetry Heals just because when I first started performing slam poetry, I'd always perform in like 6-inch stilettos. So it was just the play on words of like the actual work that poetry does to heal us. But then also just kind of my presentation style and being in those stilettos. Well, my second book was definitely a lot more catered in The Secret of Sunflowers. I play with the idea of the sunflower as just a resilient weed. And so how kind of... how I kind of view like sunflowers as like my anger as a queer person, and how I can water and tend and care for my anger in a way that other people might interpret as a weed, but I interpret as something that is, you know, bountiful and has the potential to be something beautiful.
That's really cool.
Awesome. You're very involved in the creative and LGBTQ plus community here. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important for you to be involved as an LGBTQ individual?
Yeah. I think for me, yeah, just going back to kind of growing up, you know, in Delta, community is super important for me because it's just something I didn't authentically have as a kid. You know, I grew up in the church and for a really long time, you know, I was the Jesus freak church kid who really felt a sense of community with my church until I really started, you know, questioning my sexual orientation and my identity. And so I think losing that sense of community was really earth shattering. And so for me, it is just super important to be involved in my queer community, to help build my queer community, to, you know, care for and, you know, celebrate life with a chosen family. You know, I've really worked on repairing some relationships with some members of my family, but I still do not have the authentic relationships with them that I do just other queer people. You know, I can meet another queer person just on a weekend night at a pride event and feel more connected and loved and supported by them than I think I do members of my own family or the larger community that I live in here. And so I think that's something really special and unique to the queer community that I think is worth just fighting for and cultivating. And I think also in the Western Slope, there's a lot that we have to fight against, and fighting against that kind of systemic oppression is impossible to do, and it's also incredibly dangerous to do. So being able to build a community that can work with you on activism and keeping each other safe within that activism is also super important.
So for people who maybe haven't built that community that is so important to you and that matters so much, and might be even living in a rural area, you know, or a city where they still feel alone and things like that, kind of what resources would you recommend that are available for LGBTQ plus individuals?
Yeah, I think just generally, and maybe not necessarily in Grand Junction, I took Dr. Sarah Swedberg's LGBTQ studies course at Colorado Mesa University. In that class, we really talked about the beauty of the internet in terms of connecting queer people. There are obviously some terrible downsides to the internet, especially social media. But I think that the internet is a great tool for youth, especially youth that are in really rural or isolated areas, for them to be able to find online, you know, support groups or chat rooms. I think back to when I was in middle school and like that, you know, the Neopets, the virtual pet site.
Oh, yeah.
yes. Yeah. Neopets are all dead now. But I remember just, you know, like before I had really accepted my own sexuality, like, you know, I had met like other queer people through that site and like got to build these virtual friendships with people who were authentically living as a queer person. And I think that really helped me as I was kind of struggling with my own identity. But I think now, especially, you know, there are all sorts of chat groups and for all sorts of interests for queer people that you can get engaged in.
Yeah.
Here locally in Grand Junction, I think for youth, especially the challenge can be, especially if you don't have a supportive family, it can be hard to find that physical space to connect. But I think in the Grand Valley, there are a couple support groups for youth and teens especially. So there's MOGI, so Marginalized Orients Gender and Gender Identities and Intersex People. It's a support group for youth and teens. The House or Chorus has also launched the Phoenix Initiative, which is an LGBTQ youth group. The House and Chorus cater to houseless youth, but that particular group is open to any LGBTQ youth or teens. There is also a really awesome project called The Rainbow Closet, which is just a kind of pop-up LGBTQ clothing exchange, which is also a really great resource for trans youth who may not be comfortable living publicly in that identity, but still want to be able to purchase clothing that aligns with their gender.
Okay.
That's awesome. What's next for you as a poet and an activist?
Next for me as a poet, I think, is continuing to build on Slamming Bricks. But I have also accepted an artist in residency through the Mesa County Public Libraries this year. So I'll be doing that August through November of 2022. And so it's some designated studio space and a workshop building. And I think I really want to utilize that time to work on a book related to the gentrification of Grand Junction. I think as someone that has grown up on the Western Slope for pretty much my entire lifetime, and then being in Grand Junction in the last decade, it is really disheartening to see all of the issues that we have related to how we treat marginalized folks, and then how now we, I think, are leaning into this notion of progress as development. And like the really painful repercussions that that can have for the most marginalized among us. So I think there's a blend there of the poetry and the activism. But I think especially in Western Colorado, sometimes like I don't get to dictate where my activism takes me, because there are plenty of bigots out there who are always, keeping us on our toes and having us, needing to mobilize to kind of help people. So,
what advice would you give to slam poets who are just starting out?
I think just do it. I think a lot of people are so hesitant about the performance aspect because it's so nerve-wracking, and you are so nervous about what people are going to think about your performance. And I think a lot of times, like especially in slam poetry competitions, like that competition factor makes it more intimidating than it really is. I think in every slam poetry community, whether explicitly queer or otherwise, that I have participated in, to borrow from like the Mercury Cafe in Denver, it's not about the points, it's about the people. And I've seen that philosophy in one way or another integrated at all kind of slam poetry events. So people are there to like listen to what you have to say. They're not there to judge you on your ability necessarily to do so. So I think you can only get good at slam poetry if you get comfortable, presenting your work in that way. So if there's not like a specific slam poetry scene, like there wasn't for me, I think when I started out in Grand Junction, just go to open mics and put yourself on that mic. If it goes terrible, you don't have to go back there or you can give yourself a break. But I think, don't underestimate yourself and just trust what you've written and go for it.
Great.
Do you have any writing or activism related events coming up soon?
And I just think in the spirit of Pride Month, even though Grand Junction Pride is happening in September, there are still events that will celebrate Pride that will be happening in June of 2022. And two that I think that I would share is on June 25th, so that's a Saturday, the Paradise Theater in Paonia is actually hosting Paradise for Pride. So it will be an open mic, just an event celebrating all types of queer artistry. So poets, musicians, drag queens, stand-up comedians. So it should be a really diverse and good time. And I'm really excited to see something like that in Delta County. So definitely worth checking out. And then for folks who are maybe not interested in traditional Pride events or who are more outdoor enthusiasts type of folks, on Sunday, June 26th, first Friday and second Saturday, which is a Grand Junction LGBTQ social gathering, and then an LGBTQ drag show that happens on the first Friday and the second Saturday of every month, are partnering with Paddleboard Adventure Company in Palisade, which is a paddleboard shop that I manage. And we'll be doing a pride float called Paddle with Pride on the Colorado River through the heart of Palisade. And then we'll be doing kind of an after Pride celebration.
And where do you guys put in for that paddle?
So we put in at the Palisade Rim Trail head.
Okay.
So there's a little boat ramp there that goes, there's a bridge by North River Road, and then we get out at Riverbend Park. So it's a pretty easy and mellow, like 1.5 hour to 2 hour float. So people of all different skill levels can join, kids can join. We help arrange shuttling to get back to the shop, and we'll do kind of some dancing and drinks and food and things like that after.
Awesome.
Caleb has agreed to read one of his pieces of poetry for us, titled Heirloom Tomatoes.
So this poem is called Heirloom Tomatoes, and it actually started, I was thinking about the word unravel, and it was like during the peak of the COVID epidemic when we were kind of all locked away, and I was thinking just about the way that I, as an extrovert, felt like I was just absolutely unraveling being kept at home, had just kind of like the fabric of society felt like it was unraveling around me. But then, like so many times when I write poetry, it turned into something completely different. During the course of like the COVID lockdown period, I also been doing a lot of genealogical research on my father's side. I don't have, like I said, a connection with my family. And so a lot of those stories or those, you know, those history of my family I'm not familiar with. So I was just doing some digging with my roommate at the time. And so this Unravel poem turned more into a poem about generational trauma and what I had learned about my family through some of that research. So I have been spending a lot of time with the word unravel. I like the way that my tongue tosses the syllable, holds the spool tight on the roof of my mouth, and flips it into the universe off of my bottom lip. My great-grandfather, Gilpin Red, was Colorado middleweight champion, made a name for himself giving blokes a mean bottom lip, carried the shotgun suicide of his father in his fists. I think that I carry it too, at least when I'm opening a can of tomatoes. Big hands run in the family, red-stained family heirlooms. And I reckon that that was my grandpa's secret to peaches and my father's excuse for his hands on me, a great-granduncle that killed woman, a granduncle that killed childhood. Abuse is just entropy in perpetual motion, too many stars collapsing under the weight of their own gravity. The remnants of a big bang like the one in Canyon City Cemetery. And 100 billion years from now, every one of them will blink out. In my lifetime, it is predicted that heirloom tomatoes will go extinct. And Gilpin Red's gloves are still on display, fraying and begging to unravel. I'm still learning who I am, still making amends with time, still learning how to love these hands, knowing they will end with me.
Oh, that was really good.
Thanks.
It was so smart, too. Like, as a scientist, I'm like, look at you talking about things going extinct.
I think it was that, you know, poem about the unraveling of COVID. And I think also just thinking about, yeah, the looming environmental collapse. And so, yeah, just all of that kind of blending in together. And, yeah, again, learning how to create that space to process all of that.
Well, and I think that reaches a lot of people who, you know, want to look into the history of their families. And for whatever reason, whether it's adoption or because they've been kicked out of their families because they're queer or for other reasons, may not have that tie, right, to be able to ask those questions and that loss that can't be repaired. And that was really beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks
so much, Caleb. If you'd like your own copy of Heirloom Tomatoes, it's published in the first Slamming Bricks anthology, which you can buy on Caleb's website, calebforganchick.com, along with his two collections of poetry, The Secret of Sunflowers and Poetry Heals. You can keep up with Caleb on Twitter and Facebook. Grand Junction is celebrating Pride this September, so if you're in town, we hope you can make it. This year's Slamming Bricks Poetry Slam competition will be on September 10th, 2022. And the second Slamming Bricks anthology will be for sale at the event. It will also be available for sale online to support future Slamming Bricks competitions and anthologies. Next up, we're doing a panel discussion with Finian Burnett and Kimberly Cooper Griffin, who are joining us via Zoom from British Columbia and Denver, respectively. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Before we get started, here's a little bit about Finian and Kim. Finian Burnett is a trans author, professor, doctoral student at Murray State University, and MFA instructor at Southern New Hampshire University. Their self-published book, Coyote Ate the Stars, took first place in the Writer's Digest Self-Published Book Awards. And they've published a handful of books with Sapphire Books Publishing, including two Rainbow Award-winning titles. Finn has also enjoyed tons of success in the flash fiction arena with four first place pieces in various writing contests and festivals, plus many other honorable mentions, nominations, and shortlisted pieces in the past few years. Since 2015, they have run the Writing Academy at the Golden Crown Literary Society, also known as GCLS, and they served as Director of Education for several years.
Kimberly Cooper Griffin is an award-winning author of contemporary romance novels about strong women who overcome big personal hurdles. She's also a software engineer. In 2018, with colleagues Skeeter Buck and Jason Arnold, Kim co-founded Inkstax, which is an online platform for writers that simplifies the ever-complicated bookmaking process. Kim and Finn both conduct workshops under the Inkstax umbrella, where writers can deepen their skills in storytelling and book planning. For the panel discussion, co-host Avery Brooks will be jumping in with Kim and Finn here and there to weigh in on some of these questions. For our listeners who don't know, Avery is an evolutionary biologist, sapphic romance fiction author, and an editor. So my first question for you all is, when did you know you wanted to be a writer and how did you get started?
Okay, I've always known I wanted to be a writer. Since I was little, I was writing all kinds of things. I've always written in journals and long emails, long letters to people. But it was only, that's about 15 years ago now when I started writing. And I started writing my very first book that I published. It took me 10 years to get it down. But in the meantime, I did 12 other manuscripts too. So it was a long road to get there.
I also always knew I wanted to be a writer and in fact wrote my first stories when I was maybe 5 or 6 and my mom would bind the books for me with yarn. And I always just grew to love, I loved writing all through my life. And in high school, I had a teacher that compared me to William Cotswinkle and Sylvia Plath, which was huge to me. And I really saw myself as writing for my entire life until I think it was senior year. And then it's just a bunch of teachers and a bunch of people in my life told me that, oh, you can never make a career of writing. You're a good writer, but you're not good enough. And I really took that to heart at the time. And I didn't write anything. I mean, not even in a diary for almost 20 years until I finally came back to it, wrote my first novel. And then it was just since then I haven't stopped.
That's pretty incredible. It also speaks to the power of a teacher for better or worse. So I'm glad you started writing again. All right. So as members of the LGBTQ+ community, how does your personal identity and experiences as part of that community show up in your writing? And does it impact the audience you write for?
I definitely think my identity shows up in everything I write. In fact, I have a novella in Flash coming out in the fall that's all about a trans man who is dealing with the intersection of transphobia and fat phobia, the challenges that come from living in a fat, societally seen as female body, but being a trans man. And so obviously that so much of that comes from my own personal experience, even though it's a fictionalized narrative. And I think that when you live in the outskirts of society, when you live in what would be a historically excluded group, you can't help but have your identity go into all the work, whether for good or for bad.
My identity definitely shows up in my work. Early on, it was almost as if I needed to feel like I needed to cram every bit of that identity into every story I wrote, which is interesting. Now that I mentor other writers, I'm seeing that same thing. And this idea that you want to be seen in the writing that you're doing. And I started writing lesfic 15 years ago, specifically so other people could see themselves in the writing and the books that they read, because I accidentally picked up a book one time. Actually, I didn't accidentally. My first girlfriend handed me a book, and that was the first time I'd ever seen myself in a book. And it felt so surreal. And it was so, it just knocked me for a loop. And after that, I decided that I wanted to be somebody who helped push that visibility for people. And I'm going to continue to do that. Although when I first started publishing, I was kind of nervous about that. I was really afraid of how society would see me as a single dimensional person just because I'm writing about sapphic characters. And I was very nervous about being seen that way and being pigeonholed into it. And now I know that I don't have to be. I've written in other genres and there's a lot more acceptance about having characters that are of anything on the spectrum of the LGBTQI spectrum. But at the beginning, it was really nerve-wracking. I was afraid people would look at me and say, oh, look at her. She's a one-dimensional person. And oh my gosh, there's lesbian sex in her books or something along those lines. And I just didn't want to be seen that way. Now I don't care. I don't care what people think about me. I write what I want to write. I don't feel like I have to jam pack it into everything. And I've been able to grow that way. And I hope other people can see that too and be able to do the same thing.
Over time, has your writing changed along with your own evolving identities and social and societal changes?
I definitely would say my writing has changed in that, first of all, like Kim said earlier, I'm way more in your face about it now. I don't really care. If someone's going to have a problem with my writing because I include queer characters, that's definitely going to be their problem, not mine. And if someone decides not to read me because of that, that is also their problem. But the other thing that has evolved is as I've become more comfortable in myself, you know, like Kim said earlier, it doesn't have to all be in your face. Every single character is this queer character. Now I write, I mean, I'm liberal enough. I even write about straight people. I have, you know, like even have straight couples in my writing, you know, like, you know, I feel like that's a real step up for me to actually showcase some straight people in my writing. So yeah, it's evolved with society and also with myself. But I have also noticed that as the tables turn politically, that I find myself wanting more to put some political things into my writing now to kind of showcase and be a social activist.
I would say, yes, my writing has definitely changed. As I said before, I was very aware of trying to push things into my writing that I thought needed to be there. And now it's more organic. You know, I don't feel like I need to force something into it. And because of that, I'm able to get more topics of note into my writing. So for example, one of the things that I tried very hard not to do in the very beginning is do anything that would make a queer person look bad, because we already have enough of that. In the world. Everybody sees that. So why put that into my books and make yet another person that is a stereotype of what we're trying to break free from? And now I don't feel so bad about putting somebody with a negative trait in there, because I'm also creating these larger, more deep characters. They're richer characters and they're real people. So if you don't put in some of the goods and bads, the flaws and some of the perfections and that kind of thing, if you're always trying to elevate things, you're going to actually turn off your audience if they're always saying, oh, you only just do the good sides of it. So I actually write more real now. And I thought I started out as real and raw, but not at all. Now I'm a lot more real and raw with regular people. And I feel a lot more comfortable about writing about anything. If it comes up in the writing or the muse takes me somewhere, I'm going to write it.
Cool. So since we have this kind of opportunity for the Pride episode to talk to a trans author and different members of the LGBTQ community, I wanted to address one topic that I think maybe some people struggle with. And that's when you're kind of in a tricky situation where you may know someone who's transitioning and you don't know how to have those conversations with that person, or maybe you met them after transitioning and things like that. And so I think a lot of people, you know, want to be respectful and not say the wrong thing. So they might not say anything. And then that can look bad as well. Like they're not honoring that journey or what's going on. So to both of you, but especially to Finn, you know, do you have any advice on the best way for people to kind of navigate pronoun changes and also navigate when a slip up does happen, you know, how both parties kind of can navigate that together?
For dealing with your friends or family who's transitioning, the one thing I say is just refer to people the way they want to be referred to, whether you understand it or not. So I think people really want to understand things, and you don't have to. Like, you can just say, I don't understand this, but I know that you want to be referred this way, so this is how I'm going to refer to you. And I will say, when I first changed my name, I didn't make any announcements. I just changed my name on social media, and I'd already done so with the people that are close to me in real life. And my friend Casey Richardson, who you all know is a wonderful lesbian author, was the first person to message me and say, what pronouns will I be using? And at the time I was still so new, I said, you know, I don't know yet. And she said, no problem. Just let me know. I'll say whatever you prefer. And it was just kind of opened it for me to be like, okay, this is someone who is going to refer to me however I feel is comfortable. And so being a safe space for someone is really important. And then Kim, do you want to take the, like, what to do if you slip up part of that? Because we've had this conversation.
Yeah, sure. I think that it's more important to listen when it happens and just find out where the person that's going through the transition, where they put themselves, because not everybody is the same way and it can be confusing, and to ask questions if you are confused. It's better to me, my experience with people that have been transitioning is to be able to take their lead always. And so Finn and I have talked about it because I slip up. I knew Finn prior to everything. And to me, the essence is there and it's always the same person, but it's not the same person. This is a new person. This is a person who's become who they really feel comfortable being. And at first I was so nervous about slipping up because I didn't want anybody to think that I was having these issues. But at the same time, it's not about me. So it was like, I can't talk about it. But I just talked to Finn and I said, Finn, I'm so sorry about this. My intention is there, but that's not good enough. I need to be very specific so that other people see that as well. It's not just me and you, it's everybody seeing it. So we talk about it. And I screw up still sometimes. And at first I had to stop myself and apologize. And now I don't apologize because Finn and I had that discussion about, hey, should I stop and apologize or not? And Finn said, no, I know where you're at, but it's me and Finn right now. Somebody else may have a different experience with Finn. I'm not sure if that helps a little bit, but again, I feel actually kind of uncomfortable talking about my experience when this is not about me. This is about me trying to be supportive of my friend.
Yeah. And Finn, did you have a response to that?
Did. I love the idea of not apologizing if somebody said, you know, if you misgender someone and they call it out, to just say thank you. And then that doesn't put them in the position of having to say, oh, it's okay that you did this thing. And instead that you're just giving them the grace to say, well, you're welcome. And then the other thing I would say is just make sure you're referring to people correctly when they're not there, because that will slip out if you're not doing it. And then I misgender myself sometimes. I lived as a woman as she for 50 years of my life. So it happens. The other day, you know, my wife changed her name to August, and the other day she referred to herself as Joy. That's going to happen because she lived her entire life like that. So you have to be prepared for mistakes. And I would say don't dwell on it, but come from a place of good intention, like Kim said.
Yeah. And I think you both hit the nail on the head too with a comment as you were responding of intention. It's very clear what someone's intent is if they're trying to do it passive aggressively or don't respect your choice and that kind of thing, versus if someone's really trying and feels bad about messing up. You know, I think that matters a lot.
And I love the thank you versus sorry thing. Thanks for that. I'm going to take that home.
Okay, so does activism or representation play a role in your writing, whether in the themes and characters you choose to write about or in the choices you make regarding where you market, where you do book signings and events?
I'll go ahead and pick this up first. I try not to make activism super upfront in my writing because most of my writing it's a romance area and people are trying to escape, but I don't want to shy away from it a little bit or as much as I have in the past. I want to actually bring some of the political parts of who we are as a people in the LGBTQI community, but I don't want it to be preaching. I, as a person, am an activist. I go on marches and that kind of stuff, and I don't push it to everybody around me either. I don't just announce it to everybody that's around me. So I want my characters to be kind of like me, although I think that there is a place for it in writing for people to put that in their books. If they're doing historical fiction, definitely bring it up. If they're bringing it up in another way, do it. It's what feels comfortable to you and what your genre is and that kind of thing.
I also want to give us credit because when you write a queer character, whether they're facing homophobia or facing transphobia or just having a romance where they meet and get together, that's a political act by writing queer characters, living their lives happily, because so many people still think that that is something that shouldn't be happening in our world. So a lesbian romance is still a political act, in my opinion, even if you're not actively putting social justice issues in your novel. Writing a trans character is still a political act, even if all they do is go shopping and fight with their partner and clean up cat puke from the floor.
That's relatable.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like in the context of the world right now, hard to separate the two.
And Kim, I know you're based in Denver, but in terms of where you choose to do events and book signings, do you take into account independent bookstores that are more supportive of the LGBTQ+ community?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to go with people that are going to be more embracing of our community and that kind of thing, not only because I want to make it safe for my community to go there and be there, but also because I want them to feel good about it. I want to amplify their good choices, their support of the community. In the last few years, it's been tough because of the COVID thing to be able to plan these kind of events, and we're just getting back into it. But yeah, I feel a lot better supporting the things that happen with our community in mind than going out and just trying to get more visibility through maybe a bigger media outlet or something. I'd rather do a radio thing than get onto a big network thing, although I wouldn't say no, but I would, because I'm helping other people be able to support themselves and feel good about what they're doing.
And Finn, I know you're in Canada. Is it different than, like, say, somewhere in, you know, Denver's pretty liberal, here in Western Colorado? It's
not so much.
We're not there yet. Yeah.
It is different. I mean, I'm in small town British Columbia, so my options as far as indie bookstores or queer-owned businesses are pretty limited. And even like the writing festivals that I go to, they're not specifically LGBT plus festivals. They're just writing festivals. But because we're in Canada, I've never felt, even here in small town Canada, I mean, my wife and I walked down the street holding hands, or when I changed my name on social media, immediately my family doctor called and said, oh, are you changing your pronouns? Like, it's a very liberal sort of situation here. So not that Canada doesn't have its own issues in some ways, but it's a different experience. I don't have to feel that I need to be within a queer community in order to feel safe.
You know, I'd like to add to that. Finn is talking about how they work within the writing community outside of the queer community. And in our work with Inkstax and our classes, we've actually been able to bring in a lot of those people that Finn has been able to work with in these workshops, either as a participant or when Finn has taught another workshop. And I don't. That's something that's happened because I do work so much in the queer community that I have a hard time getting outside of that community. And it's not because I don't want to. It's just because that's where I choose to spend most of my time. And I found that I need to branch out a little bit more so that I can get a little bit more of that, you know, just immersing myself in the not queer community. It's easy to do because you're so comfortable. You stay in your comfort zone, and getting out of that is something that I've decided I want to do. And by doing that, hopefully by virtue of doing that, I'll be able to spread our community towards the non-queer community.
Awesome. We're going to pivot a little bit and go into you guys' writing styles. Finian, you're working on a queer Shakespeare retelling. Can you tell us more about how that idea came about and the importance of representation in classic tales where communities are often erased?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I mean, I teach British literature, and I'm going to say that as far as the traditional canon go, Shakespeare is probably the queerest of the traditional canon anyway. I mean, come on, you can read queerity into almost anything he writes. And let's not pretend that Hamlet and Horatio weren't lovers at some point before Hamlet went with Ophelia. So really, Shakespeare is already queer. And I picked the queerest Shakespeare, which is Twelfth Night. So I'm doing queer Twelfth Night retelling. But the reason I wanted to do it, first of all, because I just love Shakespeare. And second of all, because I really think it's cool to tell people I'm doing a queer Shakespeare retelling, and mostly because I don't want the queerity in Shakespeare to be you have to look for the subtext in order to find it. There's not going to be a queer subtext in my book. There are definitely going to be, here are these queer characters doing these strange things, and everyone, of course, will have their happily ever after. So yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's been kind of on hold as I've been in my semester from hell, but it's definitely still on the burner there.
Nice. So you both have a variety of genres that you write, including flash fiction. Can you talk about your individual journeys to these different genres?
Yeah, I never thought I was going to write outside of sapphic literature. Prior to that, I thought I was going to be in contemporary literature. But when I got into sapphic, I thought that was going to be it for me, and I was happy with that. And then started Inkstax and ended up writing a couple of books. One of them is a collaboration with Finn on how to write a book. So nonfiction how-to books on writing became part of my genre collection. And then Finn really got me into flash fiction. Finn gifted me with a thing to this thing called NYC Midnight, and it's a flash fiction contest. But with the NYC Midnight, I started a whole different love for literature and writing that I never thought I'd get into, because it's flash fiction is so short and it's to the point. And I think it's elevated my writing in a way to get to a place, but it also allows me to experiment with all kinds of things like horror. And I actually am going to read from a flash memoir piece that I put together. But yeah, I can experiment in all the genres. So I have flash fiction stories in all kinds of genres. So yeah, I started off thinking I was going to be one way and changed along the way.
For me, I wrote six novels. I had six published novels. One was self-published and one was a fantasy. The rest were sapphic fiction. And then I went into my doctoral program and I could not write anything and also be in college and teach college. And it was just too much. And I just started, I mean, I know Kim and I had conversations a lot where I said, I just don't think I'm a writer anymore. I'm never going to publish anything again. I just think I'm done. And she just kept saying, no, you know what, just work a little bit each day or try to carve out some time once a week. And then I ended up, COVID hit, and I ended up at a British author's flash fiction workshop by accident. I mean, just with scrolling Eventbrite for something to do. Grace Palmer was the author. And the first piece, she gave us a prompt and I came out with a piece and I thought, oh, this is really good. And I submitted it somewhere, like didn't even edit it or anything. And it got accepted. And I was like, whoa, like total instant gratification fix, right? So I just fell into flash fiction after that. I'm so in love with it. Like Kim says, the best part about it is you can experiment. You can write literary fiction, contemporary, go into speculative, try a little romance. I mean, I'm writing a novella in flash now that's all based around Star Trek. So, you know, like, there's very limited. I mean, there's unlimited what you can do with it. So yeah, I will probably, you know, finish my novels at some point, but I will never give up flash.
Oh, you guys are really selling the flash fiction thing to me. It seems like you both are on this boom of flash fiction.
Oh yeah. If you haven't tried it. Yeah.
Come to one of our flash fiction workshops and you will be, you know, addicted for life.
So you kind of mentioned it, but I'll just ask this anyway. So what do you most like about each genre you write in, and how has each kind of improved your skills as a writer? And now that you've kind of dabbled, and not really dabbling, you've published in many, is there one that you like the best?
I like contemporary literary. That's kind of, you know, like the Bath Flash Fiction Award and Reflex Press and all of the British flash fiction publishers. That kind of genre appeals to me reading. So that's really what I like to write. So I consider contemporary literary more of my number one genre in flash, but I also don't know how much that translates into my novels. I feel like when I write one of my novels, they kind of come out to more of like a romantic comedy sort of Sophie Kinsella sort of type thing.
I would agree with you on that, where it comes out for you. My favorite genre to read is actually horror. I love horror. I love romance too. So romance horror would be great for me, but I write in romance because I feel closer to it. It shows, you know, I'm able to have people visible that matter to me. So flash fiction, that genre, which is not a genre, it's a way of writing, really helps you to experiment. And I get to write a lot of horror in that. So that's a good one. My wife always tells me, you should be writing in horror. And I said, I don't want to live my life in that. I can't imagine spending 6 months to a year writing a horror book and feeling those emotions so intensely for that amount of time. So I'd rather be in the romance thing. And I think she would rather me be in a romance mood as well.
I really feel we should write a romance, lesbian romance horror.
Let's do it. It's a collaboration. It is now set in stone.
All right.
So you both have published multiple works and multiple genres at this point and in multiple ways. So can you talk a little bit about what your publishing experience has been like? And have you focused more on the traditional publishing route or self-publishing or kind of a hybrid of both?
With mine, it's a hybrid of both. I started off with wanting to do the self-publishing because when I started writing, that was the hot and upcoming thing going. But I couldn't find a way in. It was so much. If you go into the publishing route, there's so much to know and it's so overwhelming. Lots of people can do it though. It's gotten easier over time, but there's a lot to it and your self-confidence isn't there. So when you're trying things, that self-confidence isn't there yet. So a lot of times you feel like you're not doing it right, even if you're doing it perfectly. So I actually went the hybrid route where I have a publisher who has actually published both of our nonfiction books or both of my nonfiction books and the one that Finn and I collaborated on, Night River Press. I guess that's a plug, but they help people get through the self-publishing aspect. So you're not truly self-publishing, you're working with them, but it's much more like self-publishing than it is traditional publishing. And then I went the traditional publishing route because I don't have time to do all the stuff. Even though I know how to do it now, I don't have time to do all of the publishing aspect of it, chasing down codes and getting things put together for copywriting and just putting together the formatting of a book. I just don't have time to do that now. So doing the traditional publishing, and there is definitely a trade-off. You have a lot more autonomy, you have a lot more ownership, you have a lot more creativity in the self-publishing. And then when you get into the traditionally publishing aspect of it, you lose a little bit of that. But to me, it's a really good trade-off because I don't have to do all the other work.
I went the traditional route for my first novels as well. I self-published one, and I loved the return on investment for that. I felt that I definitely, because I was getting all of the royalties from that, that I did feel I made more money on that book than any of my other books. But it was so nerve-wracking, and I had to do everything and pull everything together. And I just really love showing up at a conference and knowing my books are already going to be there because my publisher took care of it, and I don't have to worry about trying to find out what table they're going to be on or who's going to sell them. And when Kim approached me and said that, you know, did I want to do the books through Inkstax? I'm like, do I have to do anything or just show up and write and then promote the book after it's done? And she said, that's all you have to do. And so I don't ever see myself self-publishing again. Not that I disrespect it or anything. I think there are some people out there that do self-publishing phenomenally, and I would say more power to them. They are amazing that they can do that. But to me, it's so much stress, and I just want to be the write and show up person. So I could say I would probably not ever self-publish again.
So that kind of relates to my next question here. Can you describe just how hard it is for an unpublished author to get a book from idea to popular success? And also, how does Inkstax help in that regard?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question, because success is different for everybody, right? So writers go into it with certain expectations. I think one of the first ones is fame and money. You know, I don't know how many people that I know that I think are super successful, but they're probably not making their living at writing.
I thought I would never have to work again once I published my first novel. That was literally before I published it.
Oh, that's crazy. I kind of thought that it would be a nice income stream, but yeah, you have to keep on working at it. But the difficulty about getting into writing is more about being okay with ambiguity and being okay with trying things and not succeeding and that kind of thing. So I wouldn't say that it's a continuous abyss of just being sad and disappointed all the time. It's not that way. There are lots of wins along the way, right? Just starting to write a book and feeling the flow go is a big win. And Avery, you, I'm sure, have experienced quite a bit of this too, as you go through and you write your books and you feel really good about having gotten your first chapter done, and then you get your first draft done, and then you go through your editing process and you see this beautiful thing come out of it. And then you have your baby. And then you go through postpartum depression after you've had your baby, because you're not writing anymore. You have to figure out what to do with this baby that needs a lot of work still. And then you have to do your editing. And some people find that disappointing. I find that actually, I love that part of writing, is the editing part of it, making it more and more beautiful. But then you have to stop that at some point too, because you can keep on playing with it. And so to talk about just how difficult it is, a lot of it is just being able to stick with something and to take the good and not to dwell on the bad, because there will be a lot of frustration there. There's a lot of unknown. There's a lot of things that you don't expect to happen that do happen. It's a lot of work. People who think that they can just pop out a book without thinking about it probably are going to be disappointed when they get into it. But because I'm the person who's supposed to be out there telling people, get out there, write your book. You know, that's what Inkstax does, right? Is we're supposed to inspire people. We're supposed to be giving them the motivation to do their books and telling them how to do it. It's a guided path. So that guided path is what we are leaning on to make it so that people can get into it, know that there's a path that they can go through, and to also know that there are so many different paths outside of the path that they're taking that they can start making their own path going forward when they decide to do it again, if they decide to do it again. But the bottom line is you have to put the time and effort into it. And it's not really talent. You have to have an idea of having words going in there, but that's what editing's for. It's about having a good story and having the time and the effort and the motivation to go through something. And that's what Inkstax is trying to do, is to get that motivation and that path given to them so they can get to the end point and do whatever they want with that book once it's done.
To make that kind of a little more specific, I want to say that if you have not ever written a book and you want to write a book and publish it and be successful, you've got to sit down and write it first. So one of the things that we did with the Inkslinger book is we tell you how to start from you've never written a word, to sit down, to plan your book, to outline it, to give yourself a roadmap to get to the end of the book. And along the way, Kim did most of the work of putting in the marketing and the target audience and all of that sort of information, because you know, she's so much better at all of that than I am. But you have to write it first. And that's definitely what we did with the books, is we tried to tell you that if you've never written a book before, or if you've written books before, but you need help getting out the next one, you can start right here, right now with this, and write an entire book with this information.
That's awesome. I have also heard it takes a little longer than anyone ever thinks.
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah.
I remember when I first got started in the Writing Academy with you both, Finn as the director and instructor, and then Kim as the fellow classmate, I was like, I can't get started. I don't know how to format the Microsoft Word page. I can't write the book, and then I'll have to like reformat it. And then you had, you know, our guest speaker come in about formatting, and then I was like, shit, now I don't have an excuse. I have to start writing this thing.
You know, that right there is something to take into consideration, because people think it's so easy to write a book. They imagine themselves in a coffee shop with their wonderful pen, because they picked up this special pen and their neat notebook, and they're doing this thing in a coffee shop. And then you have to sit down and format it or transcribe it or whatever. And you're sitting there going, well, I don't know what people need. You know, I don't want to have to transcribe it or format it. And then what does somebody else need? You're going to figure that out on your submission criteria too. But you don't know that as a new writer. You're thinking about the story. You're not thinking about formatting a document.
Maybe if you want to touch, Kim, just briefly on where Inkstax is going, because, you know, you have this kind of guided pathways for different people, depending on what they're looking for, accountability and things like that. But isn't there like kind of a community support piece to it?
Absolutely. The community part is the biggest part of what Inkstax is about. And we started off creating the software aspect of it, which is not the biggest part of Inkstax. It's just a way for people to write. And so we started creating the software on it. But the part that's always been the motivator and the thing that inspires us for everything that we're doing is how we build community while we're doing it. So writers, it's a very solitary experience. You're sitting there in your chair and usually in your pajamas, and you don't feel like you're part of any kind of community, and then start getting depressed maybe, or just feeling isolated. So there's a lot of different ways to find that community, and doing that through social media was a big part for, I know Finn is very active on Twitter and gives a lot of people inspiration through that. And just being able to sit there and look at the writing community on Twitter keeps people writing, keeps people going, and just at least talking about writing. And if you're talking about writing, you're going to want to write. And then when you want to write, you're talking about how to write, and you share that stuff back and forth. So I don't know how many people I work with on a daily basis just through conversations. And that's what that whole idea is, to build this community. So there's a community aspect of it. So if you go to our classes, you become friends with some of the people. We put people into forums so they can talk amongst themselves. Eventually the software will actually help with that, but we don't want to create a new Facebook for writers or any of that kind of stuff. We want to make it so that it's not something that's a heavy lift for writers, because most of us are not very technically inclined. Not saying that we can't do tech, we just don't like tech or that kind of thing. So to make it as organic to the process as possible would be the best thing to do.
So I have your book here. So this is Inkslinger, 99-Day Guided Writing Experience. We're recording here in the Central Library for Mesa County, and this is a library book. I ordered it through them, so we have it here for all the people in Western Colorado actually listening. It's awesome to have a book, and you can read through it. You know, if people like that format better. You have the software and accountability part. You have the workshops and classes and things like that. And then you also have lots of tools and resources or little kind of downloads for people who want to, you know, make a schedule and that kind of thing. So I think you're hitting on all levels, which is really cool. And so wherever anyone's coming from, whatever age and ability with kind of technical and software, I think you guys have put something out there that everyone can benefit from in multiple ways.
First of all, I just want to tell you, I love you so much for getting our book in your library. That's awesome. When you're starting a business, from a business perspective, it's the wrong move to try to get the net out as far as you possibly can. You have to focus. Then you start building out that way. And that's what we're doing. It's been a 3-year long process so far to get that going. And we're starting to finally feel that stride. And most of that's coming through the education aspect, the workshops that Ben and I are doing. And once we get that bigger, and we want people to take our courses because we just really believe in what we're doing. We think that it inspires people. And if I can give one example of that, there's a person, I'll leave their name out of it because they will recognize themselves in this broadcast, but somebody that both Finn and I know that is a prolific writer and a good writer and an award-winning writer and a very confident and wonderful writer took one of our workshops because they were having a hard time with keeping the passion in it. They had gotten in a rut. They weren't feeling it. They were having a hard time keeping going because they thought it was the same old, same old. And they got into it. And it wasn't because we had anything that was amazing. It was the passion that came out of the workshop. And that's where that community is. You have to know what you're talking about. So we do know what we're talking about. But I don't think that anything that we say is revolutionary. It's just about telling telling them what our process is, a process is, and then being able to move it and telling people that there's all this opportunity out there. And giving somebody that passion back is probably one of the best things that's happened to me within the work that we've done through Inkstax, is knowing that someone who is in love with writing was having a hard time with it and now got that back. And that was pretty awesome.
That's really cool. I'm just going to say one more thing. I adore you both. You're two of the best humans I know. And then Christy's a quick third there as well. But when we were all in the Writing Academy together, Finn's enthusiasm and also Kim, as I've gotten to know you through the years, like, you two inspire me all the time. So as someone who's like going through that postpartum depression, I don't know if there's like a max limit on, is it like 5 or 10 years or something for that next book? I think so many people would just enjoy being around the two of you because your passion is infectious. And of course, it's combined with your skill and your experience and your love for teaching that comes through as well. All right, I'm done marketing you for everybody.
I just want to say that's so very mutual, that admiration and love and respect is there too, Avery.
Aw, thanks.
Oh, big group hug. I'm happy to like get to learn more about Inkstax and Inkslingers. So speaking of loving teaching, everyone here, and this question's for Avery too, everyone here brings different shades of experience to the craft of writing. Kim, you're a software engineer. Avery is an evolutionary biologist and an editor. And Finn teaches British Lit and is a professor. Can each of you say how your other disciplines have informed your writing? Does teaching deepen the craft of writing, or has writing been an escape from the other disciplines?
Writing was definitely an escape for me at first. I've been in tech all my life, not on purpose, it's an aptitude rather than a passion for me. But I started writing to escape from my job in technology and found myself writing about technology, because you write what you know at first. And those are the 12 manuscripts that I'll never see the light of day, and the fact that they were more like a journal about how my life was going at that time in the tech industry. So that's how I got into it. I have never taken, outside of high school, any kind of writing classes. When I went into college, it was all technically based. Everything that I've done, you have to do business writing. So I learned how to be a business writer, which is completely different than writing prose. But I'd had that passion before that. So I brought that into it. But I think that the mentality of who I am as a person, having a creative side and a technical, logical side, has made it easier for me to press forward as a writer. And I don't think that I would have been able to write. I have 10 published works right now, and I have 3 in the works right now. And there's no way that I could have pushed through that without having a logical, hey, I'm a project manager, let's do this. You know, if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So that's my journey. I look at Finn every day and see their passion through teaching it, through learning it. They're in a PhD program right now that we talk about it all the time. And I feel like I've taken this course with them because it's there's so much passion coming in and they're talking to me about it. And I'm jealous, you know, I want that PhD at the end of it, but I haven't worked for it. It's just my love for it. So that's my journey. It's just taking in my life and bringing it there, but that's just me. There are 1,000 different stories out there.
For me, I don't think it's possible to separate being an English teacher and being a writer. They're just so intertwined. But I actually started teaching the Writing Academy before I became a professor. I think I was almost done with my master's in English at the time, and I got involved with GCLS, Golden Crown Literary Society, and I was supposed to be an assistant for the Writing Academy, and I think I assisted in 2 classes, and then the former person running it kind of took off. So I was left with this program that I just kind of evolved into what it is today. I've been doing that, what did you say, that's like 7 or 8 years?
I think it's 8 years, 8 classes have graduated now, right?
Yeah. So the Writing Academy was actually my first passion in teaching English to adult learners outside of academia. And I think that naturally led into academia. What the difference between them is, with the Writing Academy, I get to choose what I'm teaching. Whereas in academia, it's like, well, you're an English teacher, so you're going to teach American literature, even though you know nothing about it except for what you've read in your master's program. So yeah, the Writing Academy is my first love of teaching, but they're all intertwined. What I do for GCLS, what I do for my colleges, and what I do with my own work. They all inform each other, and I'm always learning. And the stuff that I learn while I'm taking workshops for flash fiction comes into what I teach my students, and the things I learn in my doctoral program come into what I teach my students. So I would say that I have very limited separation of my various hats that I wear.
I think that brings together a lot of things, because I was already a writer before I started taking the Writing Academy with you, and my published 3 books already. And then I took this class, and then I realized, oh, these are all the things I'm doing that I need to do differently. Now, not to say that they were bad. They got me where I was with getting 3 books published, but it was an eye opener to say that there's an easier way to do it. And your enthusiasm with it, and the way that you pull in people and you build that community around it. We had a lot of guest lecturers and we worked a lot together. So there was a huge community that happened in the Writing Academy that actually was the inspiration for Inkstacks. Just put that out there. So when Finn gives me credit for having put together things like target audience and things like that, I give credit to Finn for having given me the inspiration to say, now everybody needs to know this. So how can we make that happen?
It's true. We're such a mutual admiration society, but one of the reasons we work so well together is because we come together on the love of writing. And then Kim is also very smart and very logical. And I think that I'm smart, but I'm not very logical. I can tend to be flighty. So we work really well together. I'll a lot of times have these really pie in the sky ideas like, oh, we should, you know, rent an air balloon and go in it and give classes. And then she'll work out the logistics of how to do that. So we are a really good team. But Avery, to kind of throw it back to you, I've always been fascinated with you being a biologist. I love sciencey people.
Well, thanks. And as you guys are telling this story, you know, I'm just thinking, what a foreshadowing the Writing Academy experience was of Kim and I were in it as students, but she had already published 3 books. I was writing my first novel ever. Finn was leading it as the director and teaching most of the classes. And then we had some incredible guest speakers as well. But yeah, my background was I was an evolutionary biologist. I taught probably about 20 different courses in biology, not necessarily well, climate change, anatomy, physiology, everything. And one of those was scientific writing. And I was here in Grand Junction on the Western Slope. And there was pretty much no gay community for me that I saw. And I would go home on the weekends and read lesfic romance all weekend just to find some sense of community and then give me the strength to show up on a Monday and be the only gay person I saw, you know, and continue on. And then finally, I really took a leap. And some of those books I had seen that they had won GCLS medals, Georgia Beers and Melissa Braden. I was like, what is this GCLS thing? And Googled it and I was like, oh, and on a whim, this is right a month before I resign from academia forever, I went to a GCLS conference in Chicago. I went to grad school in Chicago, so I got to see some friends from that and heard about the Writing Academy and was like, you know what? There's still seats open. I'm going to apply, resign from academia after I get back. There's a little like 1 week space in there where I thought more about it and then, you know, got accepted into this Writing Academy. And it was such a huge change. And I just want to say it gave the building blocks because while I taught scientific writing and all that kind of stuff, I had never really taken, you know, creative fiction writing and that kind of stuff. And so you gave the building blocks. You're hilarious as a teacher, Finn. But also the community I made in that was incredible. You know, I was surrounded by other LGBTQ individuals. And some of them I do weekly calls with still because we're such close friends. There's some of I call them big sisters. You know, they're some of my closest people. But for me at the time when I started writing, it was so different because I'm so used to scientific writing where everything you say needs a citation behind it. It was so freeing to be able to just write with your imagination and not have to cite anything or explain your rationale and that kind of thing. Now that I'm more of like the editor side full time and I, you know, do freelance editing for other authors, so that's fiction. I also do nonfiction. There's a bit less separation between those two because when you're looking at words all day, there's only so much brain power I have, as you guys all can clearly see. It's a newer position, so I'm still trying to figure out when you're working with words all day, how to like put away that time to then be creative and that kind of thing and still work with words. So yeah, I guess that's where I come at it from.
So it was an escape that kind of turned into this eclipsing thing?
Yeah, eclipsing is a good term. So can one of y'all kind of explain just formally what the Writing Academy is for people that might be interested?
Absolutely. It's through the Golden Crown Literary Society, or GCLS, and it's about a 9-month intensive writing program for people who write sapphic fiction, which is basically queer women in any permutation, whether it's non-binary or bisexual women. We're trying to kind of get away, I think, from the label of lesbic, because we're an inclusive community as far as like anyone that wants to write within that sapphic fiction label. But we give classes on all elements of craft of writing and various elements of marketing and how to pitch, and we'll do generative writing workshops. And the cool thing about the Writing Academy is, I think, two things that no other programs have. First of all, that it is all for sapphic fiction. Second of all, that we offer a mentorship program with the Writing Academy, and that is someone from the sapphic writing community who's an established award-winning writer gets partnered with one of the Writing Academy students and mentors them through their manuscript at the end of the program. And that is a really phenomenal experience. And I will say, and I don't normally like to brag on myself, I'm really good at pairing people with their mentors. And Kim, I think you can speak for this, because I paired you with an amazing author, Radcliffe, and that became a really great relationship.
Absolutely.
And then you have the community, as you said, lifelong community. The students, they get to know each other. They can write with each other. They can talk to each other about the homework. They can complain about me giving them too much to do, and they can bond over all of that. And I guess I could just say right now, this is the first official announcement about it. I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, that we're having a Writing Academy 2 starting in September that Tammy Bird, the director of education, and I have been working on. So coming up, we will now have 2 programs of the Writing Academy.
It's so exciting. Avery, we need to do this together.
So what is it?
It'll be open to anyone who's been through Writing Academy 1, and it's going to be a deeper dive into some of the craft elements and then a big focus on the marketing elements. We've been working on the classes, and there are some incredible classes coming. And it will also include a mentorship as well. A private donor has donated to pay for mentors for the Writing Academy 2. So we will have mentors for the Writing Academy 2 as well.
That is so cool. And y'all, you heard it here first.
Kim's going to go leak it on social media before this airs, you know.
And so kind of building off of that, we talked about teaching, but we wanted to bring this also to the Writing Academy, if you had more to say about that, or the Inkstax workshops you do. So you both spend a lot of time focused on educating writers. Did you want to tell us any more about any endeavors or topics you're addressing now through your workshops and classes beyond what you just mentioned?
So far, we've put out 2 different classes, one for flash fiction. It's a 6-week course or a 6-hour course. We're moving around a little bit on the times on it, so you don't have to commit to a whole 6 weeks worth of work, but you can do maybe 2 days with 3 hours each, that kind of thing. But flash fiction, going all the way from what is flash fiction, how to start it, where do you get your ideas from, all the way to revising it and everything in between. And that comes off of, Finn's put together tons and tons of classes for different people throughout the last couple of years on flash fiction. And so they've adapted it to what we're doing. So that's based on that. And it's been very, very well received. And then the other class that we're doing is planning your book. And for people who think that planning something takes away your creativity, a lot of people say that they're pantsers. They write by the seat of their pants. They just sit down and write whatever comes to them. That is wonderful. And that is cool. But it's not true that they're not planning it, because you need to know where you're going with it. And that planning workshop is something that helps a lot of new writers, but also experienced writers as well, when they need help with motivation and that kind of thing. But that one goes from how to plot your book, how to outline it, how to talk about character sketches and how they relate to your outline, and the motivations and projections of the arcs that go through the story until you get to the end and you have a roadmap. And all of our workshops are based on being able to have an end result, and you'll have something in your hands, either a bunch of flash fiction stories that you could submit to people, or you can have a roadmap for that. And then we have other classes that we're planning going on, and we're going to do some mentoring as well, and some just plain old workshops where you come in and do generative writing exercises and just keep on writing to keep your juices going, and other things about, you know, just a class on POV and things like that. But it's not just classes, it's a workshop. You're learning it and you're taking it and putting it into your writing.
I also have a bunch of flash fiction workshops coming up through other organizations besides just Inkstax. So my website, I guess, finnburnett.com would be the best place to find them. I list all of my upcoming events. And yeah, I even have a live one happening in September at the Wine Country Writers Festival.
Sounds fun. All this sounds so super helpful. beyond helping all writers better understand the craft and getting their work published, what specific hurdles for craft and publishing exist for LGBTQ plus writers and other writers who write LGBTQ characters?
I think LGBTQ characters are kind of coming into the forefront of literature right now. I think you're seeing mainstream writers writing more queer characters, and I think that one of the hurdles we have to really make sure of are that isn't happening is that actual queer writers are not necessarily maybe getting the attention that straight writers who are writing queer characters are getting. And I think we really have to be careful to make sure that we're still centering the voices of people who have the actual lived experience, as opposed to perhaps a straight cisgender person who is writing a trans experience. Not that they shouldn't have trans characters in their novels or gay characters in their novels, because they should, but they should then be lifting the voices of the queer people writing about their own experiences.
There's definitely a balance there. So when you have a mainstream author that is a cis heterosexual person writing something, it gives visibility to it and it makes the audience thirst for more. But if they're taking up all of the writing opportunities and publishing opportunities, the people that are actually living the life and own voices don't get to see themselves benefiting from what they are. You know, it's almost like a cultural appropriatism. And we have to be very careful about that. We don't not want it to happen. We want to support that. But there's only so many stories that can be published in a year. And if they're all done by the mainstream, but this is not a problem that only exists with the queer community, it exists with the female community, it exists with marginalized communities everywhere. It's just a problem we've had with publishing. And that's why some of the self-publishing is so critical. So they get out there and they get seen, and then they get pulled into the mainstream and they are the mainstream. So that's what we need to do, is build that path from being where you're at into the mainstream and making sure that we're very intentional about it.
Good points. So we're going to end on a lovely question. What is the best part about being an LGBTQ writer?
The community. I love the community. It's everything. It's part of my entire life now, is the community of writing. I've met so many wonderful people through conferences and getting that community together and feeling part of it. That's my favorite part of it.
Well, Kim stole my answer with community, so I guess I'm going to say that the best part about being an LGBTQ writer is that I don't have to worry about what my hair looks like, because people expect queer hair to look like this.
Which is wonderful.
I mean, community, what else is there other than community? Like, that's the whole thing that's so great for us, right? Like, that we bond together and support each other and lift each other. And how exciting is it when you're on Twitter and Karen Callmaker retweets your post about your upcoming book? Like, that's huge. Our community is so close and so supportive. So yeah, you know what? I am stealing your answer. I'm making it mine too.
Well, then I'm going to change mine too. You know, there's all the chicks that dig me. I'm just kidding. My wife would kill me on that one.
That is true, too.
Avery, do you want to weigh in on that?
I'm enjoying this so much. I'm just sitting here like an idiot smiling. So, you know, I have to say, too, getting back to something that Finn had said earlier about just writing queer characters as a political act, you know, even if it's just a romance where you're not even necessarily directly talking about politics or anything like that, for me, just as importantly as giving representation to the real lives that we live as queer people, was for people to see themselves and also say, hey, you don't have to be perfect to have, you know, the happy ending, you know, and that kind of thing. And so taking into account trauma and things like that, which isn't specific to LGBTQ people, you know, but it doesn't always have to be this like flowery view of what things are, but let's be more real. And I know Kim and Finn, you both do that as well, in terms of you are incredible storytellers, but you also get into real issues, you know, whether or not they're specific to the queer community. And so I respect that about you all. And I have to say, though, GCLS, I never expected the amount of support and encouragement, and for sure not the friendships that come out of it. So I would say, if for that alone, anyone who is looking into writing women, loving women fiction, start there.
Thank you all for being part of this cross-continental conversation. So next up, Finn and Kim have both brought work to read for us. Here's Finn's incredible 200-word flash fiction piece called That Poor Girl.
That poor girl. Forgiveness is the first step on the path to healing, your sister says on the phone, because she's at his bedside and he's dying and wants to know why you won't come see him after all these years. Jamie Lang said your father touched her and you remember how he laughed with the cop who came to the house. You'd all laugh. That poor girl, so messed up. Then your other sister's friend said he touched her too. And oh, that poor girl, didn't she know how affectionate he was? But then the exchange student from Japan wanted to go home early. And come here, Aiko, he would say, putting his arm around the back of her legs as she stood awkwardly next to him. And you and your sisters laughed over how weird he was and asked each other why he and Aiko always went to the store together alone. And it wasn't until years later when you told your therapist, and poor girl, she said, and you realized, poor girl, you should have said something, spoken up for her the way no one spoke up for you. I'm not coming, you finally manage. Your sister hangs up crying, and it's patently unfair that he's the one on oxygen when you suddenly can't breathe.
I love that story. It's so painful.
All right, so next up we have Kem's reading, Catching Trains, a memoir and flash piece.
Catching Trains. If I had to assign a flavor to 1985, I'd have to say it was the bittersweet citrus of the original Bartles and James wine coolers. They came in bottled four packs back then and were the standard cure for a bored teenage girl living in a backward California town where the only thing to do was drugs, drink, or dudes. The last option was the worst addiction by far for most, because when you got stuck on one, you usually couldn't leave. Central Valley dudes were the kind that ruin lives, the kind there is no support group for. Mostly, I stuck to wine coolers, because by the time you were on the fourth one, you had the courage to catch a train. All we ever longed for was to move to the big cities or the coastal towns where we would find others like us, kids who wanted to change the world, or at least change our fates, and sometimes go dancing. But being young and trapped by expectations, more often we slid into the shadows of massive oaks or walnut groves to escape the repression by playing on car stereos loudly, dancing with closed cigarettes dangling from our lips, and yelling into the darkness until a light came on in a farmer's house and we had to hightail it out of there in search of another quiet place to release our ennui into the air that hung heavy with the scents of dairy farms and the acrid smoke of burning almond husks that clung to the earth and our sweaters. The ubiquitous haze hung low in the valley, never leaving, like our hopes and dreams. By now, we were ready to catch a train, and a caravan of cars would careen through the night down county roads, the canal on one side and cotton fields on the other, until we got to the place where we could park on the frontage road out of sight of the cops and hike to the highway median, the long grasses rustling against our legs. Our destination was the crotch of the 99 and 198, where the tracks ran under the highways through a narrow concrete and metal tunnel. We'd wait for the light of a lumbering engine making the curve a couple of miles or so down the tracks, the whistle warning as it crossed Caldwell Avenue. We'd hurry into the tunnel to find spots where we perched on concrete ledges, standing in the darkness, pressed into the shallow safety of the vertical steel I-beams, calling to one another, making bets, taking dares, reminding each other of the girl who not only caught the train, but caught a chain swinging from one of the cars. This was a deadly game. Our hearts would race as the sound of the train sped toward us, and each of us wondered if we'd accidentally jump before the pressure in the darkness changed as the train raced in, a gust of wind and the oppressive rush of damp, stale air pulling and pressing at the same time. Bartles and James in the back of our throats, fingers tightened on steel beams. We could no longer hear each other's voices, just the steady rush of tons of metal flying by, never knowing if the train was 100 cars long or a shorty, secretly hoping for a shorty because you couldn't breathe, couldn't move. But the short ones reduced the storytelling tension, which didn't matter anyhow, because the trains were always a mile long in the retelling. When the train was gone and the exhaust of silence bore down upon us, it always felt like walking on Mars, the gravity so dense it took a moment to move, and there was that one time when the guy I was dating moved through the dark to check on me, and when he found me whole, the exhilaration was so intense that the kiss was electric, out of this world, and we did it standing up, blind but feeling our way, the heart-pounding elation sending our blood racing, and our senses into the stars that pulsed and exploded into the hazy night sky. He held my hair as I left Bartles and James in the tunnel. Then we were running back to catch up with our friends, laughing and singing. The future loomed like a freight train coming up fast, and all we could do was hold our breaths and remain still in the darkness to see how it went. When the train flew by, inches from our faces, but miles beyond our realities, when we saw our potential in a fast staccato percussionary rush, our heartbeats, breaths, and flexing fingers, catching the tempo while waiting for our potential flash by. We never intended to fling ourselves aboard. We only went for a glimpse of exhilarating dreams. Instead, the journeys to our hopes and dreams took another transport towards our futures, some on the same tracks, but different trains, others accepting what our town offered, fading into the valley haze like our youthful dreams. Time flew by and I made it out with the help of the U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Valentine. But the boy with the electric kisses lost his way in the neon lights and barroom fights of a chain restaurant just a few streets away from the community college we all attended. The taste of our past is bittersweet citrus, evoking a time when some of us caught trains and some of us caught chains.
That was awesome. Thank you. On behalf of the Western Colorado Writers Forum and all of our listeners, thank you so much, Finn and Kim, for sitting down virtually with us today and for sharing your work with us. You can find more about Finney and Burnett, including their blog, upcoming workshops, and book titles at their website, finnburnett.com. And they're also on Twitter at Finney and Burnett. That's B-U-R-N-E-T-T. To find more about Kimberly Cooper Griffin, including her latest book, Soul Cycle, which comes out today, June 14th, visit her website, kimberlycoopergriffin.com. Soul Cycle is set in Denver, and cycling enthusiasts will particularly enjoy it. Kim is also on Twitter at kcoopergriffin. For more information about upcoming Inkstax workshops and courses, visit inkstax.com. Kim will be at the Bold Strokes tent in Denver Pride in June and the Inkstax table at the GCLS conference in Albuquerque in July.
The Western Colorado Writers Podcast is the official podcast of the Western Colorado Writers Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Grand Junction, Colorado. The forum's mission is to foster a rich and diverse writing community on Colorado's western slope that invites participation from diverse cultures, customs, and life experiences. The forum hosts Writers' Night presentations at the Grand Junction Center for the Arts on the first Tuesday of every month, where local and national writers give presentations on their craft. Sign up for the forum's free newsletter at westerncoloradowriters.com. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Western Colorado Writers Podcast. And if you have thoughts or suggestions for the podcast, please drop us a line at westerncoloradowriterspodcast@gmail.com.